We all search for different words besides shooting people when we do our work. But for me, I really think about the different ways in which me as a body, I'm in space with people when I film. So one of the first things that happens when I get asked to talk, I often get asked to do a master class. So there's some assumption that I am a master, which I'm not saying that in a self-deprecating way, but I have no wish to have mastery, nor do I wish to be a master. And so I'm here by saying, like, one more word we could, like, throw out, right, is the master class is just, like, I think can just head on its way. And we did that yesterday. I was at Stanford, and we decided it was a workshop, and it worked fine, right? But so one of the things I think that we all think about, because I believe that you're all practitioners here, whether or not you actually hold cameras, as audience members, we're also practitioners, right? We're in the practice of watching and seeing and taking in films together. So one of the things that I have been thinking about with the work that we do is the ways in which we are seen and we see, right? And so here I am, I'm going to command the room, I'm going to give a master class, I'm going to stand in front of you some of the time. And then the rest of the time, I'm going to move around and be with you in the way that I do as a camera person. But I'm just going to start out with the idea of seeing and being seen.
Hello.
Yeah. Okay. So you've been chatting. You're chatting. And actually, I think, you know, we will need more light in the room. Can we open up the light in the room? So does everybody have a person? Okay. So now you get to, we're not going to work with words. We're going to work with seeing. So everybody be quiet to the extent that you can. And are the lights going to be able to come up? In a moment, they're going to come up. But what I'm going to ask you to do, and does anyone not have a partner? Because I want to be your partner. Is there not an odd person? There's one person left. We can do the twin. And you don't have a partner either. This is the numbers. All right, you two are going to do each other then, and I'm going to watch everyone else. You guys have to get close to each other. Can you come over here? So what you're going to do is simply. Stare into each other's eyes for 2 minutes. All right. So you need a partner. Okay. All right. So boom. Will you time us? Okay. All right. Everybody ready? Okay. Let's go. All right. 30 seconds. I'm just going to tell you, did you see how we expanded time? Was that crazy? Right? That was long. That went on a long time. I just want to hear some feelings. How was that for you?
Fascinating. I can't wait to do this with my students, actually. Yeah.
So what was fascinating about it?
Well, first of all, one of the things I noticed perceptually was that I can't, my two eyes can't look at both of his two eyes at the same time.
Guess what? You're not the only one.
Right. So that would be the first observation. Yeah.
Right. That maybe hasn't occurred to most of us, right? You actually can't look with your two eyes in the two eyes of another person. Because what your brain is doing is putting together two separate images, right? And how many of you know which one is your dominant eye? Boom, she knows. All right. A few people know which one is your dominant eye. You can find out immediately what is your dominant eye. Stick your arm straight out and line it up with the vertical edge of that screen. So look at it with your two eyes open and your fingers sort of transparent in a way, and you can still see the vertical thing behind it. Now close one eye, and either it will stay on that vertical line or it will jump to the side. Okay, how many of you are left-eyed? Boom. How many of you are right-eyed? Boom, right? It's just, it's one of those things, right? And back in the old days when we would look through a viewfinder, if you were left-eyed as a camera person, you'd die a little inside because it meant the rest of your face had to be squished against the camera and you couldn't see with peripheral vision. But so that was your first observation about it. What else? You had something else.
Well, I am a teacher, and so I'm understanding more and more that young people need an opportunity to connect with one another, and you know, it's something that a lot of us in this room do already naturally through our own work, but that a lot of young people don't know how to sit with one another in the way that we just did, and so I think it's an important exercise.
I mean, a lot of people, period, right? Like, that was uncomfortable. Who had a really hard time with it? Anybody? Oh, yeah, coming over to you, coming over. So prepare yourself. Why? What was hard about it?
I felt like I was blowing through, like going through a roadblock. I was blowing through all these social taboos. Like, fuck that, fuck this. I'm gonna keep looking at you. Are you uncomfortable? Because I'm still coming.
That was you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So what was going on for you?
I didn't experience it that intensely, but what I really experienced intensely was the indecision about which eye do I look with.
So you were preoccupied sort of with the mechanics of it, and you were like, give me your inner self. Yeah, I need to look away. How many people had that I need to look away? Ooh. Whoa, okay. How many people thought more about being looked at than looking? No one will admit to that. Look at that. Boom. A couple people. It's really interesting when I do this with young, really young people, teenagers, people will say all they were thinking about was being looked at, right? So maybe that is a thing that shifts over time. What do you got? You got something?
No, I thought there's some sort of indecency in looking. I'm sorry.
I think this is a very profound thing you're saying, that there's some sort of indecency, because it's transgressive to be that close to someone you do not know, and it's embedded culturally also, and some places culturally you don't look in the eye of someone older than you, you don't look in the eye of someone who's a different gender from you, you don't look in the eye of someone who's not your family, right? So I think indecency is a great word that comes up there. I think shame's an interesting word there. How was it for you?
I was just surprised how quickly we went from laughing to feeling really sad.
Yeah. The transition from like a big smile to like a world of hurt is often quite quick, right? It's just like, woo, which is maybe why we don't often look people in the eye, right? Anybody else got something about their experience of doing it? I'm looking at, I'm feeling you.
Nothing. No thanks.
Why are we doing it? So you two are in a good spot together, because you're like, I'm not using words about this, and I don't know why we're doing this. So there was a tension around questioning the actual doing of it, in a way. And I think this is what filming is looking and being looked at. It's a very fraught space, and sort of toggling around through your comfort and discomfort, and making your own choices and rules and having agency about it. Like, in some ways, like, you articulated, I do not wish to speak, right? You pushed back on my, I'm putting a microphone in your face, which is the kind of thing that happens when you're filming, is that there is resistance. And the question is, do you push further? Do you walk away? And I think one of the things that's really interesting about the 21st century is the shift in agency of people we are filming, right? Which is exciting. People understand more about what it means to be filmed than they ever have in human history. And so that there is more agency in people's responses. So, I mean, that's the thing I feel about this conversation today, is like, we're having a conversation. I'm going to come close to you. I'm going to move around. I'm going to ask you things. But I love that we have the like beginning of, you can say no to me. Right? And you can answer, not answer. All of those things are our choices. And I think that's the kind of thing when we get caught in a system. So this is a great way to like see the system. We're here in this group of people. We don't know yet how safe a space this is. We don't know who everyone is. We all are seen and being seen. And there are things that we know about each other that we don't know about each other, right? Some things are visible on the surface, some things are happening on the inside. And these are all part of the filming work, right? So I had a few words that I thought I would say about filming and what it's about. So I think it's about time. I think it's about the body. I think it's about the eye. I think, for me, Carlo Rovelli, you know, who's this physicist who's talking about time and, like, where does time come from? The present. Where is the present? He says the present emerges from our perception. And in some ways, I think it emerges from our, like, the sort of the web of all of our shared perception of the present moment. So I'm standing here, I'm up here, but each of your relationship to time is different because you're sitting, right? Because your bodies are all doing different things, you have a different relationship to this experience. If I asked you all to stand up and stand on one leg, your relationship to time would be totally different. It would expand again the way it did when we were all together, right? And that's one of the things that when you hold a camera in some really difficult position, right, like I've decided I'm going to be here doing this, suddenly time becomes stretched, right? And that's one of the things that, for me, I love about the practice of doing it is that I keep being reminded that I'm a body. And so we've got our internal experience of what's happening to us, the external things that we're recording, and we're navigating all these ideas and perceptions about a person who we don't know, right? So we were all speculating about what we saw in that other person's eyes. We don't know what we saw. We don't know that that was sadness in the eyes, right? So Cecilia is here, and she knows who's the most photographed person of the 19th century. Couple of you are nodding your heads. Who doesn't know and will take a guess who's the most photographed person of the 19th century? Go for it. Boom. You got it. So the most photographed person of the 19th century is Frederick Douglass. Was that just a guess or you knew? Was that just a guess or you knew? I was asking for people who didn't know to guess. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. I got that one. So Frederick Douglass had himself photographed 166 times, which is, you know, I have 2 7-year-olds. I've probably, between me and their 2 fathers, we've probably photographed them 70,000 times already, right? So there's a small difference between the 19th century and the 21st century, right? And so, you know, sort of the why of why he had himself photographed so much, he writes about really beautifully. But I started asking myself the question of why. Why did he want to be photographed so many times? And obviously there are many reasons. But my understanding from reading his writing and looking at the photos of him is that he realized that an image is a relationship. So I'm not just saying that images come from relationships. I'm saying an image is a relationship. And it is a relationship in the moment that it happens between the person with the camera, the person being photographed, and it is a relationship right now. So that you are extending the relationship, right, into space. And I think what he figured out was, in the same way that he had figured out that slavery was a construct, that race was a construct, but that people really believed in it and they enacted it, that photography is also a construct, right? And so you might say, it's a camera, it will take a picture of me as a human, but if you've already lived through a time when people created a social political structure of violence that kept you enslaved, you know that a camera won't necessarily see you as a human if it is operated by another person who does not see you as a human, right? So my sense is that he had a lot of photos taken, and in some of them he is extremely memorable, And in other ones, it's not a photo that would last through time if you didn't know his name, if he wasn't a known person. This is my favorite photo of him. And I feel like whoever was in the room with him, who took this picture at this moment, had no idea what was behind those eyes. We can speculate a lot of things, right? You know, outrage, defiance, pain, something is blazing in him that I feel like comes across two centuries, you know, into this room, right into each one of us, and says, like, if I haven't read his memoir, read it. If I haven't read his the biography that just came out, read it. If I hadn't read what he wrote about photography, because he basically imagined the world that we're in now. He imagined the 21st century, and he imagined that people would use cameras to film the transgressions happening against them that had been invisible. That is what he wrote about at the end of the 19th century. So he saw it coming, right? And I feel like his eye is like, it's not gonna be stopped by any century. That eye is just like blazing forward into the future, right? But I have no idea what's inside of him, right? So the eye is a portal between what we can gather, right, about a person, looking at them, right? And, you know, and people give each other signals. This is the great thing about being in person. Like, you just smiled at me. I looked you in the eyes and you smiled at me. So it's like, okay, I could come a little closer, right? And then she's like, put her head down and turned, right? So it's like, I want to back up a little bit, right? And those are all signals that we're giving to each other. And sometimes, as we know, when we film, we think we're cool. We think everything is great, and that people want us to film them. One of the big questions for me is always, why are people letting themselves be filmed? Are they in a position to let themselves be filmed, right? And one of my big examples was being in Nigeria, filming with a family that's in camera person, whose baby was being born and who was struggling to be born, and I was very close with the grandmother. I spent probably 5 days with her. We ate food together, we laughed together, she liked my gap tooth. We joked around, but in a terrible moment, when she needed to carry the baby from one medical pavilion to the other, it was really urgent for the baby. She was running as fast as she could, and I came around and started filming her walking backwards. And what did she do? She stopped, and she posed. Because she was a 75-year-old Nigerian woman who had lived through colonialism and thought, if a white person is standing in front of me with a camera, I have to stop. Even though her baby, her grandson, you know, was in trouble and she needed to keep moving, because she had experienced something where she might have faced extreme violence if she did not do what a person like me was telling her to do silently, right? So these are the moments where we think we've communicated things, we think people understand us, and yet our exterior self, our visual self, represents many different things to different people, and we don't always know what those are, right? Okay, so this is the 19th century, talking about images, image making, the complications of images. I'm going to go with this is the 20th century. 20th century. How crazy is this that this feels like a fashion photo now in some way, right? There's some way that this reads as like kind of an amazing fashion photo. And yet, right, this is the liberation of Bergen-Belsen, and these women have been starving, right? And I think the genocides of the 20th century really made people question image making. Right? And the Holocaust in particular was a place where people really thought and questioned what kind of images were indecent, what kind of images were wrong, could you make a fictional image to talk about Shoah, right? All of that was heavily debated in the 20th century, right? Because we were suddenly seeing things that were in the realm of the unseeable, but we were seeing them. So it created huge amounts of conflict in people. Has anyone seen the Peter Jackson, They Will Never Grow Old film yet? Oh my Lord, right? It's so incredible because, you know, he basically, like, the tagline is like, the soldiers of World War I did not live in black and white. And he's colorized everything. And the pull up the trailer and watch it. But the crazy thing is people's teeth are terrible. People's teeth are a mess. And it is the most visceral thing to see what bad shape their teeth are in. And you're like, oh, this is the beginning of the 20th century. And people suffered simply eating, right? Besides all the other suffering. And it's so striking. You couldn't, if you made a fiction film, you couldn't cast the people who had such bad teeth, which is a little bit like the Holocaust. How could you cast people who had been starving, really? The thousands, millions of people who had been starving. How would you do that? How could you create a fiction film of that? So I'm coming to the 21st century. I had a lot of fun thinking about what would be the 21st century. And I came to Ezra Miller at the Met Gala. Anybody seen this? This is Ezra Miller came into the, so this is celebrity, this is promotion of self, this is how do you project identity onto a world stage now where we are all aware of our capacity to see and be seen. And boom, look what this guy did. Like, okay, bam, hello 21st century. I mean, I don't know about you, but I find this thrilling, right? He's taking, and apparently, you know, whatever, it took 11 hours of makeup work, but sort of back to what do eyes mean? What do looking in people's eyes mean? What does it mean to be seen by 11 million people or however many followers you might have if you are transformed into a global celebrity, right? And that he can do a commentary on gender, on facelessness, on masks, on seeing, on eyes in an image is the power of what we do, right? It's the extraordinary thing about what we do. So I'm going to take you back in time. And we're going to do, let's see if it'll work. Yeah, that movie's so good. The movie's so good. And it takes us from a century where still photographic images emerged, and then they started to move, right? And Bertov was able to make that film because he was so blown away by the difference between a moving image and a still image, right? And how quickly the people seem alive again. Right? There's a way in which it becomes time travel. And I, once I saw that, I was like, oh, I gotta watch The Jazz Singer again and see what happens when people discover sound in a movie. So check this out.
Thank you. couple pals are always hard to find. Some folks have one, some folks have none.
Look how long it took them to lead up to that moment of sync sound, right? Because in the same way with that still, oh, Rodney, I'm right here, hold on. Going back, can I go back? It was so unfathomable that a person could stand up and sing and you could hear them, that they spent like a minute and a half being like, it's coming, we're going to give you a title card, you're not going to believe this, it's really going to happen. And then, boom, he opens in his mouth and he sings, right? So these are these things, they're like evidence of people coming from one way of understanding the world and moving into another way. So some of us in this room, we're like this on each side of this sort of the digital revolution of this century, right? So some of us went to college, started working, started filming before the internet existed, before cell phones existed. And we know what that means. Others of us in this room imagine what that means, but we don't know. But there is evidence of what that means, just like this is evidence of a time when people were like, whoa, moving images, whoa, sync sound, right? And that's one of the things that's so beautiful and crazy about the work that we do is that, you know, we're tied to our historical technology in these ways that we always have choices about. I think this is one of the myths of the 21st century is that technology is doing things that are inevitable. It is for the moment, or maybe not, maybe it's slipping out of our hands, people in relation to technology. The next place I was going with, for me, the defining digital moment, which is the beginning of the ubiquity of video cameras, is Rodney King and his beating that was captured from a window by a prosumer camera, right? And I ask you to look at where he is looking in this moment in this photo taken by police after the beating. He's not looking at the person in the eye, right? In some ways, he is refusing this photo. He is refusing that this has happened to him. But what happened because of that video was the beginning of evidence of things that had been hidden. And why was that happening? It was happening because of the ubiquity of cameras, right? All right, so I said that people and technology, that there's some, there's a way in which it's not inevitable. I might be wrong about that. This is the evidence that I might be wrong and that I'm too old school. I'm too deep in the 20th century I'm born in 1965, right? So I'm halfway in the 20th century. I'm barely into the 21st century, but this is a piece by Trevor Peglin in which he used two artificial intelligence machines. He fed them many pictures about things, and then he asked them to try and fool each other with images. So this is an image of a war road, right? And it fooled, one AI fooled the other AI. So this is a completely digitally created image of war that one AI machine fooled the other one, which is sort of the Turing test about whether, so this is a comet, right? So these incredibly beautiful images that are, created by machines to talk to other machines. No humans involved here other than the humans who have fed the machines with examples of war and examples of comets, right? Examples of flowers, examples of rainbows, examples of a man, example of a vampire, right? So a machine made that and talked and convinced another machine that this was recognizable as a vampire. So I posit that this is our future, right? It's an uplifting, it's an uplifting idea. What I also will say, and say to all of us, is we have to refuse dystopia, refuse fear, refuse despair actively. And one of the ways that we do that is we reconnect to the people that we love, we reconnect with people, but we also are strategic and we're active and we see systems and we see things, we try to see things coming, right? There are some things we can't see coming. So this is my mother in the 50s using a camera that she looks down into, like she's looking down into a well, right? And I found this photo after she died, and I was so struck by how it looked like the way that I film, right? I sort of looked down into the same well, and one of the things with my mom, she was really annoying to go on a road trip with it because she would always say, stop the car, stop the car. Because she'd want to jump out for a moment of light or catch something. And I find myself, like, it is literally my profession to say, stop the car. And so I'm constantly saying, stop the car, stop the car. But as we enter the 21st century, of course, we start to have this reality in which there are a lot of people around with cameras. I don't need to stop the car and get out. They're already there. People are already there. They're already in their own communities. They're already fleeing their war-torn countries, filming themselves. They're going to concerts. They're confronting police. They are doing their own interviews. They don't need foreign journalists to come and tell their stories. They are filming their handiwork. They are filming when it could put them in jail, right? My dear friend Michael filming. You know, all these people continue to document the world around them and extraordinary things happening around them, right? And then, of course, this is like this hilarious picture where she's solidly in the 20th century. She's just like, hey, this is awesome. Right? Like, and not even aware that everyone else believes they need to film it. Right? But did you notice, as I flashed through all of those images, a lot of them were traumatic. A lot of them were about pain. A lot of them were about war. You know, you think about, like, Ouija was a person who photographed accidents and who would get a call and then rush to an accident and film it. Now people who are in accidents photograph themselves or their family, right? So suddenly there's this huge capacity for traumatic images. So I'm going to show you a traumatic image, right? So this is a traumatic image, and you may have already seen it, and it may already be indelibly in your mind, right? I chose this of many traumatic images I could have shown you because this boy lived, right? But there are many traumatic images that we see of people who have died or are dead in violent ways, and it marks us, and the number of those things is starting to accumulate at a crazy pace. So one of the things that's happening with images that we're starting to disassociate from many of them. So this is from Hot Girls Wanted, Hot Young Girls Wanted. I can't remember the name of the documentary. But it's this sort of terrible, you learn in this documentary how 16-year-old girls get recruited and then how they go into prostitution. And then there's a moment where you've been following one girl, and then the screen just goes and shows you 40 girls. And then you realize how quickly your brain shuts down. You were engaged with the story of one person, right? So this is where we are perhaps beyond story or, you know, moving around with story. Story is great on a one-to-one level, but what do we do with this level of scale? We are operating on a level of scale that is unprecedented in human history in terms of the number of images, the ubiquity of images, but also the number of extremely traumatic images and disturbing things that we can see very easily and too easily, right? They just come at us before we even know they're coming. All right. Now, we're gonna watch a little movie. It's 8 minutes long. Do we have 8 minutes? I think we do. Let's do it. Okay, we're gonna watch The Above, for those of you who haven't seen it, I think. So, settle down, settle down. So my father says this is the most autobiographical film I've made. And you might wonder why that is, right? I would posit that, like the man who said it was indecent to look in the eyes, it is because in some ways I understood a really sophisticated surveillance system from the time I was a child, right? Because I believed in God, and I believed in a Bible verse that said, God knows your thoughts before you think them. And it was really challenging to me as a kid to navigate with that information that I did believe. And some of us, I think, because of the place we come from, the religion we were raised in, the family we were a part of, we understand what it is to be watched and to have our behavior constricted by being watched, right? But what's happening to us in the 21st century, right, is that the digital revolution of this moment in time is created an unprecedented situation around surveillance and the ways in which we are watched and will be watched in the future, right? And so we are the people who are actively caring about the seen and being seen, right? And this is our work moving into this century, is how do we relate to surveillance that is in many ways so different from photographic cameras, from film cameras, because the technology that gives us the ones and zeros, the pixels, means that our anything that we make or film or is projected can be tracked. It can be traced back to its origin source. Not very easily. In most cases, you wouldn't want to do that. But the people who have the capacity to do that, our governments, our corporations, and also the individuals, like an Edward Snowden, who know how to manipulate the data, who are inside a giant system and know how to move with it, right? But most of us don't have access to the level of complexity that can move back and forth in relation to our images, right? So, you know, I was trying to make a film in Afghanistan with a young woman in 2008. She was not wearing the burqa. She let me film her because I was a woman and it wasn't indecent for me to look in her eyes. But we worked on that film together, and then by 2012, she said, I cannot be in this film, right? Because by that time, cell phones had come to Afghanistan and things were downloadable, and she knew the images of her without a burqa on could be seen by her neighbors who would come and harass her parents about it. So those of us who started making films on one side of the divide, we imagined a world where we could promise people, you can safely denounce your dictator, you can safely denounce your father who is committing incest against you, you can do these things and we will protect you from the people who will find out that you said that. Turns out we can't do that anymore, right? And we were wrong, those of us who did that in the past, we were wrong about that. So one of the challenges of the 21st century is that we don't know where the images are going into the future. Turns out that was a challenge of the 19th century. Frederick Douglass was dealing with that challenge. How am I here in this moment in a way that says, I have agency, I lived through this, contend with me? And he figured out a way to do it that spoke to us across two centuries, right? And that, I think, again, I say, like, I exalt us to not fall into the inevitability or the despair of this moment in history, right? Because there have been always despairing moments in history where people have been invisible and have not had a way to safely speak their truth, right? So I've been thinking about sort of like what are the strategies for living in this moment in time, because I think one has to think about systems. And, you know, when I look at that movie, I kind of laugh about it because, like, what do I do in that moment with those balloons? Like, what did I physically do with my body? I literally walked into a bunch of balloons and, like, turned my head around inside a bunch of balloons. Why did I do that? It's fairly obvious. have feelings about color. I like it. It makes me happy, right? But some part of me, color is one of the ways that I deal with the difficulty of the world, right? And Kabul is like, it's unrelentingly a place that is filled with systems of difficulty. And so sometimes you just have to stick your head in a bunch of balloons to feel better, right? Which is what cinema often is. It's like stick your head in a bunch of balloons. And that is the sort of the joy it can give us, the like freedom from our pain, the distraction, right? But if we are only sticking our head in a bunch of balloons while there's a war going on and there's a surveillance blimp watching us, we're slightly out of touch with the reality that we're living in. We're slightly out of touch with time, right? Ravelli says that we're like fish swimming in the water of time. The presence is flowing all around us and literally through us. So the surveillance camera, the surveillance blimp in Afghanistan, it had a camera. It saw me at the moment that I was sticking my head into those balloons, right? And that exists somewhere. The mirror shot of all those shots I took of the blimp somewhere in a U.S. military archive, there I am, climbing up on a mountain, getting down on the ground to film some carrots in the market, right? And that is the kind of web that we are all in. And so I've been thinking about like sort of what are our strategies as we move forward into this time where we can't protect the people that we film. We can't pretend that we can control their images. Everything that we make can be traced back to us. So if any of you know, you know, many of the young people who filmed the Arab Spring, most photographed revolution of all human history in Egypt, there's a military dictatorship back in power. Those images are no longer accessible, and many of the people who made those images are either in exile or in prison. And that is because that material was expressing people's subjectivity, expressing their subjective take on the world. And I think that's what's so thrilling about this time, is we have an explosion of subjectivity, and we know what that means in terms of feeling like we've had a history of image making that has been dominated by a few, and that has been creating images of people that they speculated about, with all kinds of speculations, some positive, some negative, some open, some curious, in the same way that when we looked into each other's eyes, we speculated about each other. We were gathering evidence, but we were also speculating, right? And now, what changes if you can film the world from your subjective point of view? If you can film the world from your subjective point of view, how do we do that? So one of the things that I feel like it's incredibly important to do is be as specific in your subjectivity as possible, right? In making the work, be as subjective as you possibly can. That doesn't mean that you don't see systems, that you don't understand the systems that you are in the web of, right? So my subjectivity includes, I love the color orange, I'm obsessed with surveillance, I think about why women have to wear burqas, I like to talk to strangers, right? My subjectivity could go on and on and on and on like that. I know that I'm a big white woman in Afghanistan, it's really tense. If I lie down on the ground in the market and film carrots, it'll make people laugh, right? It diffuses the tension. All of those things, the seeing and being seen, is what I'm really actively doing when I'm working. And what I learned from making Camera Person was how present my subjectivity was in the material, and I didn't know it. So that's, for me, one of the other strategies, is like, we have to make work from as deeply subjective a place as we can. That does not mean we are freed from the responsibilities of trying to understand what the world is, trying to see the web of systems that we're a part of, right? The other thing that I would say, I feel like we really have to push the form in this moment in time, because there's a lot of old work that's out there that comes from a place that was not faced with the current set of dilemmas that we are now faced with. And I think we really have to struggle with them. They are not light dilemmas, right? And so I've been reading this book called Surveillance Capitalism, right, where basically she's like, yes, climate change is happening, and the attempt to commodify, to surveil and commodify each one of our subjectivity is actively underway. So they are not just trying to understand what we do and how we behave. They want to change it to make it more profitable. Our behavior is being influenced by the surveillance systems that are functioning in our world. Now, the they, I mean, this book is kind of great because it talks about the five corporations that, you know, Google, Facebook, et cetera, and they each do things differently. So it is not inevitable that this level of technology will attempt to profit from us, but it certainly seems like that's the direction it's leaning, right? And so that's one of the things I think that we have to be thinking about and questioning. And so she's saying basically it's like humanness is at stake, right? Because in many ways the systems of surveillance and the machine work that's coming does not care about our consciousness. And you can just ask any FedEx driver, right, who has to go to the bathroom at a certain time, has to deliver a certain amount of packages, can't make a choice if, you know, gets docked if they turn the wrong way on a street, et cetera, because a machine is controlling how they are delivering. So their consciousness is irrelevant. Their body is simply being used to deliver the packages. And of course, like, the effort will be made to remove their body from the equation soon. So, you know, I was all hyped up, like, camera people of the 21st century, explosion of subjectivity, everyone's got a camera in their pocket, 4 billion people. Well, machines are going to start filming us, right? And once we take our bodies out of the equation, things are going to shift radically. So one of my other sort of strategies for the future is embodied in this music video by Hisham Faghi. I'll just play it for you, just to lighten things up. Wait, I got to start at the beginning. Did I start at the beginning? I don't know if we got the beginning. Maybe we didn't. He just simply explains that his name is Hisham Faghi, and he spent a little bit of time in the United States, and he heard this song by this Jamaican guy. And at the time that he made this video, it was illegal for women to drive in Saudi Arabia. It was illegal for him to make a music video where there were instruments or women with men in the video, and he didn't break any of the rules in making this video. So these guys were in Saudi Arabia in 2011 when everybody else was getting to have a revolution, and they were going to get to have one. And they knew that they would be put in prison immediately for almost anything they made. So they made up a list of what are all the rules that we cannot transgress. And they knew them by heart already. They were already internalized, right? And they were like, okay, how do we do it? And what's so amazing about this video, which now 12 million people have seen, I think the population of Saudi Arabia is 10 million people, is that many conservative people saw this and were like, that's an awesome video. Yeah, no woman, no drive, right? But like The Simpsons, you can get the subversive content in and everyone can have a good time, right? And they did not get thrown into jail, and immediately became so popular because it's so fun that the government couldn't put them into jail once they realized the trouble that it was. Now, this, and since, women are now driving in Saudi Arabia, and I would credit it to this piece of filmed and conceptualized material, right? As well as the work of many women activists over time, right? Let's remember them, shall we? How am I doing on time? We have 11 more minutes, excellent. Well, 11 more minutes. Someone wants to ask a question. Well, the last thing I will say is that these guys understood that they are mice living in a house with a lot of fat cats. And they could very easily be eaten. And they don't want to be eaten. They want to live. They want to have a good time. They want to stick their heads in some balloons. And they want to fight the injustice of the world, right? So, I mean, that's another one of my strategies think of yourself as a mouse, a very nimble mouse, alive in a house where there's a lot of hungry, hungry creatures out there. But you're not alone. A lot of mice, other mice living in the house with you. And so being aware of our surroundings, our time, our moment in history is part of how we strategically and intuitively and empathetically attempt to deal with this new territory that we're in. So anybody want to ask me a question? Because we got 11 minutes. Yeah.
I want to make a comment. Okay. The population of Saudi Arabia is 22 million.
Oh, thank you.
And Hisham Faghih is in exile right now. The other guy in the video is not allowed to be on any videos. He's not allowed to come out on YouTube. And his wife is pinned in jail, and she's being tortured.
So there you go. Right. So this is how dangerous the house is, and this is how dangerous the cats are. Right?
I mean, I didn't find it funny.
Right. Right. You know why?
And it's because, not because of the video that the women
right.
are driving now.
Right. Of course. Do you know why you know that and I don't?
Because I know the activists.
Because she knows the activists, because they are her friends. Right? What is your name? I'm so happy to meet you. What we know in all of our interactions with each other is that we each have different wells of experience, and we each are more up to date on other things than each other person is. And that is why we give in these moments to each other, right? Because I searched to find out where Hisham was. I couldn't find it in the time that I had. I'm grateful to you that you tell me where he is now, right? And that's the work that we're doing. And also, we make mistakes. I say there's 10 million people in Saudi Arabia. There aren't. There are 22 million people, right? Right? And we acknowledge mistakes, right? And we acknowledge that other people than us have more understanding, are not the masters, but are the people who sit in, each of us sit in our own well of experience, have our own blind spots, have access to different information. That's why we talk to each other, right? So I'm curious, from your point of view, I think Saudi Arabia right now is so, there's so much about it that's so painful that there's no laughter anywhere. I also was with a friend who talks about the need for laughter and how we work with it, right? But I'm curious, from your point of view, given that update, where does that put you in thinking about what are strategies for the 21st century with this kind of repressive state in power? She has no idea, right? And I think I have no idea either. And it is updating this information and saying the cats are more emboldened than they ever have been in history, and they can find you and they can hurt you or the people that you love. That is what we are dealing with, and that is what we need to talk about, right? Because 5 years ago, let me be imprecise with numbers again, I don't know, when did they make that video? I don't know when they made it. A few years ago when they made that video, they thought it was a strategy that would work. And it did for a period of time. Right?
The activists made it work.
So this is another important thing that you're saying. Who is invisible? Whose contribution, whose energy has not been seen? And that is our work. In the same way that I'm imprecise about numbers and that my examples that I showed you, I spent time looking for images. Almost everything I showed you was made by men. Right? Because in the history of looking, and many of the things that I showed you were made by Americans, right? In the history, when you look quickly through the internet to find things, what do you find, right? What's available? How deep do you dig? How complicated do you present the world? All of us will fall short in our representation of the world. That is why we need are like incredibly specific subjectivities to speak to each other, right? You augment this day because you shift it again into the space of the now in Saudi Arabia, and you're saying, I don't know. I do not know what the strategies are. Right. And, you know, I mean, all right, exactly. We are living, you know, in a military-industrial world of great complicity between people who are not, who do not care about human rights. And they are much more powerful than we are. What do we do? And they are much more brazen than we are. My desire in this conversation is to say, let us engage with how different the 21st century is. It's really different. And I don't think we're contending with it as a community. I think we're in, our dialogues are small right now around what our work is doing and what it can do. And in our imagining of the future, and maybe I'm too optimistic. I mean, in some ways, you're sitting in the place of like, don't want to make anything in that space. Can't imagine what would be made.
I just know there's a lot of stakes.
There's really high stakes. Absolutely. And I see it in your face and in your eyes, right? And I appreciate it. And I apologize if in any way it made you feel like I was being flip about the stakes. But for real, because I really believe in the stakes and I have felt and know the stakes. But it's also, for me, I mean, I think in terms of like how we talk to each other, I think I repeat, the fear, the despair, and the pain is not the only place we need to go as humans if we are going to, you know, push back, which I'm sure the activists in Saudi Arabia who figured out the way to have women start driving have done for a long time. Not that that's any solution to anything, right? Like in many ways, it's a smokescreen. We're letting people go to the movies now. We're letting them drive cars. We're just imprisoning a lot of people, right? Is there anything you want to add? Yeah.
I guess I wanted to kind of, I just had a thought or a comment, which is, you know, on this idea of embodied, this embodied subjectivity, and the sort of extreme embodied subjectivity that you kind of present as being really important, you know, but at the same time being incredibly vulnerable, right? It's just sort of systems of what you call it, surveillance capitalism.
Yeah, hold your mic, just hold it closer.
Sorry. I guess want to kind of flag or like think about the different kind of vulnerabilities, the different kinds of bodies or different kinds of subjectivities, the stakes as well as like the environment in which those come to be are so radically different, you know, for a man, you know, even just like clearly for a woman and a man, for somebody wearing a burqa and some, you know, all of these different things. And I think it's, I mean, in a way, it's like a, and that then has all of these effects on the sort of quality of the systems of surveillance that that people are up against. And so it just seems so, you know, so complex. So, I mean, one thing is that to reveal your, I don't know, to explore or to try to present or formalize one's own subjectivity in the face of all of these, whatever, these forces of surveillance as they've kind of emerged, it's so hard to even think about what that is when there's so many different kinds of like bodies and so many different kinds.
Right.
Of
well, I mean, I think part of, I mean, I don't know if, let me interrupt you for a second, but I think one of the things that each of us only knows is the body that we are in. And it's a body that's constantly changing. It's aging. It has different meanings in different places that we go, right? That we are allowed to go. And we learn from being in our body and doing things. What are the stakes, right? And I think that's why it doesn't, when you jump into someone's reality and presume that you understand the stakes for them, you are usually wrong, or you are usually imprecise in some kind of way. That doesn't mean that you can't modify and shift your understanding in that moment, but I think you're absolutely right to look at the nature of the way our physical bodies impact the way that we exist within these systems. And that's part of why, as a practice, the practice of being in the world in our bodies with a camera is a very specific one, because the camera gives us power that we have differently to use or to abuse, to all the different things a camera can do. It changes our body. We become some kind of a cyborg in a certain way, But so that a woman, you know, I was looking at a video of an Indian woman who was filming the man behind her on the airplane who had been harassing her, and he was hiding in shame, right? And suddenly the camera is giving her different agency than she had in that situation. But that doesn't mean that he can't track that video down, find her, and she can be punished later for it, as happened to Hisham Faghi, right? So go ahead. Sorry to interrupt you.
So yeah, I mean, I'm a historian of photography and camouflage or surveillance.
Woo!
That's one of the things that I do. And one of the things that seems one of the things that seems like true historically, but you know, also in the present, but isn't so maybe discontinuous, is this idea that actually one can't even come to know one's subjectivity or one's embodied subjectivity until one actually has, you know, kind of tried to formalize it by engaging with these kind of forces of surveillance, so that one can't even know one's right. one's subjective position until one is suddenly like caught up in this system.
That's right.
And so it makes it really, you know, challenging, whether it's like 1870, whether or not you're Frederick Douglass or today.
Absolutely. And I think there's a long lead on, you know, the government not forgetting and now having the data, and at a different moment in time, one kind of behavior, one kind of choice being an acceptable choice within a government's parameters, and then it changing, right? And I certainly did not discover my own subjectivity until I made Camera Person, which was 30 years into my career. I was unable to see my own subjectivity, and it was also in relation to being surveilled, working on Citizen Four, that I understood more of the invisible system that was seeing me, which I do not know the entirety of, right? So absolutely confirm what you are talking about. One more question. Okay. Okay, I got one more question right here. Yeah.
So I want to go back really briefly to the opening exercise of looking into someone's eyes and take it back a step further to the idea of the poetics of looking. And one of the experience that I had, which was different from what other people articulated, is I was struck almost mute by the beauty of the eyes I was looking into. Mm-hmm. And it was so stunningly gorgeous that I thought about the power of looking, and it's something with the camera, I'm always looking with the camera in that way. It's like, it's this focused way of looking at something, and whatever camera I'm working with, whether it's a microscope camera or whatever, how does the image reveal? And it made me think of Elaine Scarry's book on beauty and how beauty can be a way of having agency and subjectivity and political action through beauty, which takes us then back to the politics. And this is more just a discussion to open up, but that exercise invited me into that reflection. And so I put it out there.
Thank you. Well, it has been a delight to chat with you all. And I love the way that you're all here, that it feels like I'm not alone in asking these questions about this moment in time, because I, you know, I think very vividly back to, you know, how much Susan Sontag's On Regarding the Pain of Others helped me when I was a young student, and then there was a certain moment where I read the article she wrote about Iraq, and I was in the middle of reading it, and I was like, oh, she can't help me right now. She doesn't know what it is to be me doing this work, filming. She knows a different thing, right? And I think that's the way in which we all help each other in this moment in time, and sort of being brave enough to be exposed, to make mistakes, to practice together how to be a human in relation to cameras in the 21st century, we're going to need a lot of practice, is what I think. And I think there are very high stakes. So, all right.